I was having some discussions, and I've identified Emmanuel as the founder of that in our brotherhood. I was having some discussions last night with a man who had put 2 years to Emmanuel and quit in disgust. And he was telling me that he was taught in his prophet's class, or in his Old Testament studies, for instance, one of the things he did was that he was told that the prophets were inspired no more than you or I are inspired. Or that God spoke to him only in the same way he speaks to all of us. These were simply men who were good men, godly men who wanted to say something for God, so they created sermons based on the law and delivered these sermons. And then these were written down, redactors, that's a German word for editors, added the phrases of the Lord. That were just written sermons the same way you or I might write a sermon. But then when they were copied later, redactors added the phrase that the Lord spoke, the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, the word of the Lord came. These were added later, but the original prophets never said that. Well, that of course destroyed the fabric of the Old Testament prophecy. Once y'all know, I'm not just making that stuff up. Say that, yes.
Prophecy was my question.
Yeah,
this destroys prophecy as we understand
the prophecy. How do they deal with like the call of Ezekiel? I mean, that's a lot of verses it takes up.
I don't know. I'm simply saying there's that general contempt for Scripture as we traditionally view it. I do have to say something. I'm going to go back to page 92 very quickly now. I do have to talk about Friedrich Schleiermacher. I've indicated the four most important characters in the history of the church since the apostolic age are who? Can I name them? Augustine, in order. Augustine, Aquinas, Calvin, and Schleiermacher. Those four have affected the history of the church more than any other four men. Schleiermacher, who's a German, as you might expect, for reasons I've given, he's often called, look at this phrase, the father of modern theology. By modern, we mean critical theology. He was the son of a devout pastor. He was educated in Moravian school. Remember the Moravians last quarter? Followers of Huss, they moved from Bohemia to Moravia, Count Zinzendorf gave them refuge. He was highly influenced by the Enlightenment. Let me think about the Enlightenment, which was primarily French, a French intellectual phenomenon. But the Enlightenment said that man, was the original humanist, that man is, the Enlightenment view of man is that man, if you give man a fair start, an even chance, you know, like I said before, a clean shirt, indoor plumbing, and high school education, that he'll build heaven on earth. It's the Enlightenment view of man, this positive. Communism, by the way, is based on the Enlightenment view of man. That's one reason it doesn't work. The biblical view of man is that sin has corrupted man, right? We don't believe in original sin, but that sin, man is fallen. Man tends to sin, right? That's the biblical view of man. The Enlightenment view of man is that man is basically good. The goodness of man, which never works. Communist Marxists found out that if you put a man in a position and say to him, we want you to work for the good of society, we want you to claim no more than you need and to work even though you don't get compensated for it, that man refused to do it. So you have to have a police state. Anyway, he was a professor of theology at the University of Berlin. He opposed his colleague there, Hegel. In his famous great work, you should know this, Addresses on Religion, he set forth his basic theological theory. He said, the heart of what he was trying to do was to, really, now listen, let me tell you what he was trying to do. He was trying to save biblical Christianity, or save something of Christianity, in Germany. The Germans, because of the 30 Years' War, and the thing you talk about, God could barely get a hearing in Germany. And Christianity was on the way out in Germany. So Schleiermacher was trying to do what? misguided leaders have always done this, all the way back to Origen and Clement of Origen of Alexandria, Clement of Alexandria, all the way back to them, to try to save, listen to me, to learn this. It's one of the reasons Stenemacher is so important. He's one of many, but he was pivotal, or others weren't so pivotal. It's a fundamental mistake that's often made, and Neo-Orthodoxy represents this kind of attempt, to save Christianity by reinterpreting it to fit the current philosophical mood. You got that? To save Christianity by reinterpreting it to fit the current philosophical mood. In Schleiermacher's case, the current philosophical mood was the Enlightenment, the deism. Now, let me say to you, and one of the problems with that is that the current philosophical mood, or the philosophical mood, keeps changing. That which is the current mood will not be what is in today will not be in tomorrow. And what the church has done since the 18th century, Protestantism has done, and Catholicism to a degree, is they have played the foolish game of playing catch-up. That is, as soon as a philosophy will come off the drawing boards, even before the philosophers, secular philosophers, are sure that they like it, the Christian intellectuals will begin to reinterpret Christianity to fit the current mood, and just about the time they get it done, lo and behold, what's happened in the philosophy department? They changed their mind. They moved on. And so then the church will try to catch up and reinterpret, and then they move on. So it's a fundamental mistake, historically and logically, and certainly biblically. That's what he was trying to understand. He was not setting out to destroy Christianity. He was setting out to save it in his own mind. He said the heart of religion is not doctrine or orthodoxy. In Lutheranism, after the formula of Concord, the focus of Lutheranism is orthodoxy, not orthopraxis, not holy living, but straight believing, and this doctrine is not to be questioned. Well, if that held, see, that kind of thing was going to be thrown out by the new science, by the new man, the new intellectual. And so he said the heart of it is not doctrine or orthodoxy, nor is it basically ethics. That is what a man ought or ought not to do. It is rather experience. That is, man's consciousness of God and his awareness, his absolute dependence upon God, is the heart of religion. You see, what it does, it tries to save Christianity by making it subjective. It's always a mistake. Biblical Christianity is fundamentally objective. That is, it is true, we know it's true because Jesus rose from the dead. Now listen, this is an overarching statement, but learn this. Biblical Christianity is, while it has its subjective elements, in other words, we have our personal faith, our personal devotional life, and what we call our personal relationship with Christ, which is fine, you see. But the foundation of Christianity, the foundations are objective. That is, we know it is true because Jesus rose from the dead, which is objectively, historically established, and its basic character is objective. That is, Christianity is the business of being forgiven, being made acceptable to God on the basis of what was done outside of us or on the cross. Understand? We are not. We do not know. Listen to me. We do not know Christianity is true by an experience, nor are we saved by an inner working of God. We know it is true by objective evidence, and we are saved by an objective act of God. It's objective to us. The gift of the Holy Spirit does not save us. The death of Jesus saves us. Understand that? So it's objective in its basic character. And Satan always tries to, as I say, make every man his own Bible, to subjectify it in any way that he can. Modern charismatic movement is subjective. Modern Protestant theologies is to say that we are saved by, but we know that Christianity is true because of an inner experience. You ask me how I know, I hate that song. You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. That is utter, complete nonsense. That's not how we know he lives. So does he dwell in our hearts? Yes. How? By faith, the Bible says. How do we know he lives? Because of eyewitness testimony. But you see, by subjectifying it, you cut away the historical grounds of it, you cut away its roots. You make it vulnerable. It's
sounds spiritual, understand, to say, I know Jesus. It's like saying, I know God. Back in the God is Dead movement, Christians thought it was cute to put on their bumper sticker. I know God's alive. I just talked to him today. Which made them feel better. This idea that we are saved by a work of God within us, what it does, it makes Christianity subjective, both in its epistemology and its phenomenology, that is, how we know it's true and its basic character. And it sounds spiritual, it is deadly to Christianity. It's always been deadly to Christianity. You see, the person who subjectifies it does not have to answer the hard questions, but neither can he defend the faith. He put himself right on the level of the Mormons who say, I don't care what the historic evidence is, I've had the burning in the bosom. As long as I've got the burning in the bosom, I don't care what the documents say, I don't care what Joe Smith himself says. And he can be proved a liar on paper, historically, 1,000 times over, it changes nothing. Why? Because I've had this Holy Spirit affirmation in my heart. See what I'm saying? And so Seermacher is another version of this, trying to save Christianity by subjectifying it. Making it subjective, really. I'm sure there's a worse sense word to subjectify. I think there is. Do you understand that? I am not saying that we do not have, that there is not a subjective element in Christianity. Christianity, in its expression, in its application, it has very important subjective elements. But we're talking about the basic character of it and its foundation. Okay. Now, what this allows Seermacher to say is, therefore you can have God without the Bible. You can have God without objective revelation. It's all experience. The Bible is therefore a record of human experiences of God. Questions raised by historical criticism, therefore, were irrelevant. What does it make any difference whether Daniel ever lived or not? Who cares if Jonah ever lived? Who cares if the Pentateuch was written by Moses? Who cares if Jesus was virgin born? What difference does it make whether he rose from the dead or not? See, these were all being questioned in Germany. He said, what difference does it make? That is not what Christianity's experience with God, and the Bible simply records individual people's experiences of God. Doctrine, therefore, is nothing more than an attempt to explain human religious experience in intelligible form. Christianity is the truest religion in that it does more than other religions in bringing men into unity with the divine being. Note this, is Christian, you see, the question that not naturally follows is Christianity, therefore, how can you know if it's true or false? And he says, well, objectively, you can't know, except on this standard. Note this, this is a pitiful striving after something objective. He says, the most we can say is that Christianity is truer. That's nonsense language, of course. It's like somebody being more pregnant than somebody else. You know, that's like more unique, which is unique does not admit 2 degrees. You understand? You're unique, you're not. You cannot be more or less unique. You're either pregnant or not. You cannot be more or less. You're either dead or not. It's like saying, you know, this guy's deader than this one because he's been dead 3 years, so I'm dead too. You got that? Dead is dead. And true is true. Either it's just true or it isn't, but he got into this nonsense of saying that Christianity is more true than other religions. Why? Because it works better. That's an attempt at being objective. Well, that's a very subjective evaluation that it works better. I doubt a Hindu would agree. You would probably think that Hinduism works better, would you not? You can see how weak this is. A group of theologians called the mediating theologians adopted his starting point, but tried to be more conservative than he was. But these theologians were those under whom Americans began to study, who therefore were the primary sources of liberalism in American theological schools. And then he was followed by Albert Mitchell, and I'm not going to go into that, but I want us to understand that what Seermacher was crucial because he represented a new approach to the study of theology. And he's the father of modern theology. All New Orthodoxy, all this goes back to Seermacher. Trying to save Christianity by
making it subjective, making it out of experience.
Now, for instance, you can see the prototype of New Orthodoxy in Schleiermacher's agenda, can you not? This is New Orthodoxy. The Bible is a witness to the revelation. You see, New Orthodoxy, the difference between Neo-Orthodoxy and Schleiermacher's old liberalism is just this, that whereas Schleiermacher said the only way we know God is through experience, Mark Bruner and his outfit would try to go farther and say, no, we know God through experience, but he also reveals himself in history. He'll actually enter into history. Do things, but their approach to the Bible is the same. In either case, whereas Schleiermacher would say the Bible is simply a witness, is a human testimony of individual human experiences of God, the neo-Orthodox said, well, that's too liberal. We're Orthodox. We'll say that it is human, which is a human witness to divine to revelatory events. So that is. What I'm saying is the Neo-Orthodox allow God to do a little bit more. But their basic view of the Bible is the same, and the basic approach is subjective, the faith is existential in the case. And so it is not really the difference, in my opinion, is the difference between truth and being truly done. It's the difference between a dead man who's dead 2 days and one who's dead 4 days. One is as dead as the other. That's really nice. I don't see how you can say anything else. But this new approach was critical. What it did, it was a turning of the corner. All of a sudden, based upon Schleiermacher's basic method, different versions appeared, you understand, but the basic method is approach to subjectify it, to make experience, human experience, the touchstone of revelation, and to make the Bible simply a human document. And the Bible is, therefore, by getting rid of the Bible, you don't get rid of God. Or of the Christian faith, either. Okay. You understand that? I need to. Okay, let's move on now to discussion 20. We'll move very quickly. I'll give you this. We're talking about the growth of evangelicalism in Germany. And let's move along. This is a very interesting parenthetical study. What does the term evangelical mean? If you read much, as you should be doing in the area of religion, you come across the word evangelical. And if you read older books, you'll see the word evangelical. And books on history, you'll see the word evangelical. And I dare say, if you've read very much, you've been somewhat confused about what the term means, evangelical. So to take care of that confusion, I give you this nice little parenthetical study. In early Protestant Europe, it simply what it meant. It just meant Protestantism in general. The word evangelical meant Protestant. For instance, the Lutheran Church prefers the term evangelical to Protestant. You go to Germany especially, the Lutheran Church will often call itself the Evangelical Church. Not in America very much, because they get confused with the Evangelical Reform, which is now part of the United Church of Christ. But if you're in Germany, you see they refer to the Evangelical Church, they mean the Lutheran Church, but earlier on, the term evangelical just meant Protestant in general. In 18th and 19th century Europe, later on, especially in England, it meant those in the Church of England who wanted to be more biblical. You got that? Members of the Anglican Church who were the evangelicals, we're going to meet some of them, who wanted a more Bible-based faith. And the church wanted, church at large. Evangelicals in the Church of England, listen to me, does not mean Protestants in the Church of England. America, evangelical is defined in two categories. Evangelicals are sometimes those who have had a personal relationship with God, the phrase is used. Secondly, evangelicals are those who hold to a uniquely infallible Bible and salvation by belief alone. This category includes fundamentalists, neo-evangelicals, confessional evangelicals, and charismatics.
So depending on what context you're looking at. Okay. We've seen an intellectual movement. We now move to an evangelical movement. What was going on? We've talked about how dead orthodoxy and doubt dominated religious thought in Germany. Was, you got that? You either had those who were so dead in their Lutheran orthodoxy, they didn't care much about religion, your religion. And even today, you go to Lutheran churches in Germany, they're about empty. It's like churches of England, nobody goes, or if you go. It's true of most state churches, always true of state, it becomes true of state churches. And so you had those who were attacking the Bible. Was there not a minority movement? The answer is yes. It's called the Pietistic movement. This was a phase of a German evangelical movement. This is to try to be more biblical. The two primary leaders were Jacob Spener and August Hermann Franck. Spener was the first generation leader. He was a clergyman in Frankfurt. He preached powerfully on the need for a genuine religious experience. You see, we're going to see John Wesley doing the same thing in the Church of England later on. If the church is dead, he preached for a vitalized religion, what he would call it. The same thing today, when churches tend to get dead, that's where this term born-again Christian came from. Who's a born-again Christian? He's one who's really the real thing, really devout, as opposed to the person having their name on the church book. That's what that generally means today. So the church has always struggled with this. Get a born-again Christian as opposed to an ordinary Christian. He got into big trouble for establishing what he called Collegia Pietatis, is Latin. These were small prayer and Bible study groups. He got in trouble. Why? Because the authorities suspected him. He was forced out of his pulpit in Frankfurt. So he wrote a book called Pia Desiderii, which means a dissertation on piety, and set forth his basic ideas. He wanted the clergy to be educated toward piety, not just theology. Secondly, he wanted preaching to be revived, a new kind of preaching that would edify and promote spiritual living, not just the delivery of dead orthodoxy. And third, he wanted the laity involved, which was not in the state church. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I think we would agree with all that. He eventually founded the famous University of Halle, it's pronounced Halle, near Berlin, and the Pietistic movement sort of emanated from this University of Halle. The second generation leader of this movement was Franck. He came to Halle as a teacher, and under his influence, the movement reached its apex. I list you the major contributions of Hermann Augustus, August Hermann Franck. A benevolent work was organized in the church of the Lutheran Church. And this was the beginning of faith missions. Did you ever read the diary of George Mueller? Let's talk about this. What is a faith mission? A faith mission is a mission whereby, for which you do not raise support. You simply determine it's the will of God for you to do it, and you depend upon Him to provide what you need to fulfill that mission. And it was begun by the Pietists, whether it's a biblical idea or not, it was begun by the Pietists, and the faith mission, Carey later went out on faith. But interesting, this idea began in Germany. We used to think that all rotten things begin in Germany. Here was a rather devout idea that began in Germany. You ought to read, whether you agree with it or not, your education in church history is not complete until you read this little book, the paperback book. I've got a copy of it somewhere. It should be in the library. The Diary of George Mueller, I think it's called it. George Mueller, M-U-E-N-U-L-L-O-U-T, George Mueller. What he was a man who started in Germany at that time. He was a German. There were a lot of, there were
Did you work in Germany? I believe it was in Germany that he worked.
Not having to know.
Anyway, he was, came out of this movement anyway. I'm sure, I don't know why I'm doubting that, but for some reason I am. Anyway,
there were a lot of homeless children. He determined that God wanted him to provide for homeless children. And so he established a series of homes. And developed commissions, a whole lot of them, huge number of them. And he never asked for money. He simply published financial reports ever so often. And his policy was to pray in on a day-by-day basis what they needed to keep those homes running. Pure faith missions. Now, whether or not you agree with the theology of that, you can certainly admire the courage of it and the faith of it. The prayer life of George Mueller is one of the great examples of devotion in the history of the church, personal devotion. That came out of this movement. Important schools and hospitals were established to promote the work of the church. For the first time, a program was set to print inexpensive Bibles, because the common people didn't have the Bible because they were expensive. And a missionary zeal was created. This was perhaps the earliest expression in Protestantism of the modern missionary spirit. But note this, this missionary spirit, now hear me, it stood in opposition to the state church with the prevailing theology. Why? Because both Lutheranism and Calvinism was predeterministic. How are the saved lost? By the prevenient grace of God, not by preaching. And the pietistic movement, insofar as it, now listen to me, very important statement here, insofar as it became missionary-minded, rejected Lutheran theology. It was not rejected theology in general. It was very mystical. There was no church organized to perpetuate the ideas. That is, it was a movement within the state church. There was no separate congregation. You understand? You wouldn't go down the street and find a pietistic church. It was like the evangelical movement in the Church of England later on. It was, we're going to study later on, it was a movement within the church. It was never given a central organization. For this reason and other reasons, it died out after two or three generations. However, it left its mark on the Lutheran Church. Now listen to the results here. It stimulated a revival of personal religion, demonstrated the necessity of a conscious conversion. Fromm's own conversion became the model for others. It increased the share of the laity in the church. Promoted Bible study, promoted benevolence, emphasized asceticism, strict life. It unnecessarily minimized the intellectual element of religion, didn't care about theology. It was unprepared to meet the rationalists, therefore. They tend to be premillennial, unless the top Lord was about to come back at all times. And they neglected the social element of religion. That is, they took care of the victims of a society, but they never tried to reform society. Understand that? They would care for the orphans and the sick, but they never tried to get laws passed. Labor laws, you know, or whatever, child labor laws, anything like that. There was a tendency towards separatism and isolationism. Okay, so the pietistic movement was one phase of the evangelical movement in Germany. The Moravian movement was the second. This is very important. The Moravians identify them here. 1417, remember when John Huss was burned at the Council of Constance? John Huss is from Bohemia here. He taught the University of Prague. What happened to all his people? Well, when the 30 Years' War happened, Protestants were forced underground. Many of them fled Bohemia and went west, and they toward Germany, toward west. Bohemia was part of the Roman Empire, to other parts of Germany, other sections. And there, a number of them
settle on the estate of Count Zinzendorf. He was converted, more or less, to their point of view, and they recognize him as their leader. So these Moravians had something of a new birth. That is, they were called Moravians because they were from an area of Bohemia called Moravia. They went over to where, I'm sorry, they went over to an area called Moravia, not from there. From Moravia. Zinzendorf was in, trying to think of what area he was in. I'm getting confused here. Yes, from Moravia, an area of Bohemia, to over here, this area where this Count Zinzendorf kind of took them in. He was a devout believer, and I indicated the shape of Moravianism. It was, again, pietistic, not theological particularly. He wanted it to become a cell within the Lutheran Church, however they were forced out of the Lutheran Church. And so they did establish, whereas the Pietists did not establish a separate movement, the Moravians did, because they were forced to. And they became the great missionaries. Their purpose was to raise the level of spirituality within existing churches. That is, they were more of a, even though they were a separate group, they did not try to evangelize to expand their own numbers. That is, they saw themselves as a ministry to the existing church, therefore they were pietistic. And they went to the four corners of the world. They were the great missionaries. Look at this statement. Although they were a community of only about 600 people, in two decades they managed to call into life more missions than the whole Protestant church in Germany had been able to do in 200 years. After the death of Zinzendorf, it spread into England and America. It has remained a small but honored body. By the way, they're still around. And they don't try to get much bigger. You understand that? They see themselves as sort of a minister to the existing church. They've resisted growth by forming communities. They live together somewhat like the Mennonites, but not exactly. Sometimes they're confused with Mennonites. They're not the same at all. They're not Anabaptist, but any shade, stretch of the imagination. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. You go to Winston-Salem, there's this Moravian community. There'll be a Moravian church and Moravian community there. In recent years, there's been an attempt to reach out and grow. It's only very recently they've done this. We're going to see them later. We're going to see the importance of the Moravians. And their effect always was on other people. When we meet John Wesley, the people who really converted, quote, John Wesley, were Moravians.
Along this line of the doctrine, if they were such great missionaries, and yet they adhered to basic Calvinism, I know you've kind of tossed on that question, but where do they get the logic?
There is no logic to it. It's contradictory.
And how do you act as a missionary from Moravia? Do you go out and preach?
Yes, preach.
And if somebody comes forward, it just happens to be that they were going to anyway somewhere down the road. And
what they do is they bear witness to the lost and the elect when people in murder. That's all. It's not what you can do. You're a Calvinist.
Their testimony, their preaching actually does anything then?
No, grace of God doesn't. But they're sent out as a witness. They're not responsible for the results. Very confusing, but it is contradictory. We try to make sense out of it, but they don't. They say it's a mystery. They have bishops in the line of succession, but who furnish a kind of a Presbyterian tradition. That is, they're more heads of committees than they are sole unilateral bishops. And their worship, interestingly enough, here's something really strange. Their worship is very liturgical. We would expect, being pietistic, that their worship would be very informal, like the German Catholic Spinner and Fromm. Their worship was very informal, not the Moravian, very liturgical, very strange. Okay, so we've seen an evangelical movement in Germany. What were the two main groups? Pietists, Spinner and Fromm, one generation, second generation, and it died out. The Moravians, which were there early, came back in the days of John Huss in Bohemia, who formed a separate group, are still in existence. Both were attempts to bring what they would consider to be true spirituality into the church, to the state church. Well, England had the same problem. They had a state church. The state church has always been an adoring element. It's interesting, you know, when they, I'll just say an editorial comment on this. One of the reasons that makes state churches so dead is they're supported by, they don't, there doesn't have to be an effort to keep them alive because the state keeps them alive. It's supported by tax money. It's one of the dangers of the Bible colleges, but I think. You know, we, Bible colleges struggle to survive financially. And there's a great contradiction of Bible colleges. Our Bible college tradition have sought endowments to ensure the financial future of the college, trust funds, and, you know, so that the money will be coming in. Problem is, it's always been the ruin of colleges. Because one of the worst things that can happen to a Bible college is that they no longer have to depend upon the constituency to stay alive. As long as the Bible college has to depend upon its constituency to stay alive, it has to be very sensitive to the constituency ones. One of the reasons the disciple colleges stayed liberal was that they had been heavily endowed. The local churches could not put them out of existence because, understand, all they could do is quit sending money, but they didn't need the money anyway. They were endowed.
Along those lines, same lines, if we have to be, and hopefully this has never happened here, it hasn't, maybe it has, but if we have to be so supportive about our churches for the support we need to stay awake, stay alive, then can't we tend to cow down to not teaching what really ought to be taught in order not to?
Yeah, that's a danger either way, that's right.
You can where you can't close
your I'm not saying I'm against it, but
yeah, well,
it's a danger, I'm saying. Yeah. It's a danger. You have to watch. When I started this college, before I ever considered coming here to teach, some of those who were starting it asked me what I would do if I was going to start a college. One thing, but they didn't do it. And I said, well, I'd set it up legally so after 50 years it would go out of existence. The next generation, if they wanted a Bible college, they could reincorporate, have the land built. It would be their school, not ours.
As long as you grow, if you are in fact actually growing, then that really should be a problem, shouldn't it? Because they could always, even though you have endowments to keep together this block of the school here or whatever it is, the church or whatever, but if you want to grow, then you need more funding, so you still need to work with your constituency.
Well, of course, what happens is the hold that the local churches have over who teaches what is being taught.
That's what I said the other way. Yeah, they hold the first premise.
They do, yeah. Anyway. This is a problem of human experience, understand? And that's what state churches get into. I'm not holding out for one view or another. I'm simply saying this is a thing that has to be recognized. And then, and because state churches, they can be dead and still stay alive because they're supported by the state. You understand? You go to one of our churches, you get a church, one of our churches has seating for 700, and they're down to 15 people. 15 people simply can't keep the church open, right? The church will simply die. Without a state church. You can have these big cathedrals, you know, these huge buildings, you have to have 30 people a Sunday, you know, for 100 years. And it just keeps plugging along. This is supported by the state. Can't die. Well, same thing is true in England. I indicate the background of the evangelical movement in England and the major aspect, whereas in Germany you had Pietism and Moravianism. In England, the main aspect was Methodism. The main expression of this evangelical movement was Methodism. Here we come to the beginning of the Methodist Church. Now, what's the background of this? Just like in Germany, spiritual destitution. England was on the eve of the Industrial Revolution. Workers gathered in industrial centers, but were not absorbed in the life of the village churches. It was a very debased and immoral age for the masses of people. Let me say a word about this to understand what was going on. You see, England for years and years had been rural, had been a farming community. The whole for Europe was farming. It was rural. And what you had was people who lived out their lives with roots, whether they were landowners or what we would call sharecroppers, tenants. They
they tended to stay generation after generation after generation in the same place. This was true, and they tended, and the little, and the church, and the churches were small and local, and the laws reflected that kind of world. Well, immediately with the Industrial Revolution, mainly the steam engine, later on gas engines, but mainly the steam engine, created the possibility of the factory. The factory changed everything. Why? Because you had to have people in the factories. And that meant that people, where were you going to get these people? You know, get them off the farms, which meant you were going to uproot them from the little villages where they lived for generations. Where are they going to live? Well, they're going to live in the factory towns. What laws were going to govern that? The answer is, there were no laws to govern. Why? It was a whole new situation that had not existed before. And people who are uprooted tend to have trouble with their spiritual life. What they got was thousands of people all of a sudden shoved into these little towns that suddenly became cities. There was no planned growth. For instance, there were simple things like there were no sanitation facilities. People died of typhoid. There was no school system set up to teach the children. The churches were not ready, were ill-equipped to handle them. There were no laws to protect the children or anybody in the labor law from being exploited. And so what did people do? They came to these cities, it was a new life, they were insecure, and alcoholism was rampant, disease was rampant. It just created an unholy mess. Terrible. Can't believe how bad it was. And England just about went under, socially, morally. Now you see the problems that have been created in Orlando. Terrible problems have been created. Orlando's a modern city, but you can see even Orlando in the modern city. Look what trouble Orlando has had absorbing the growth in the last 20 years. What laws are you going to pass? How are you going to control? Do you realize that the year I came to Orlando, during those years, apartment buildings were burning down regularly. Every couple of months, an apartment complex would burn down. You know why? They were thrown up with hastily while Disney was being built, to anticipate the growth. And the city's building codes were not enforced because the city laws, the city bureaucracy was not set up to do it. There were not enough laws were insufficient, and there were not enough people to do the inspections. So they threw them up. They were not up to code, and they burned down. And that's just a modern sense. And look what's happened. Orlando absorbed the growth, right? And you got money, and you got all kinds of good things. But we also got the South Point Boston Trail. We got topless bars. We got traffic jams. We got sanitation problems. What I'm trying to teach you is, in the modern age, sudden growth, where suddenly people move in to an older community, creates terrible problems. In the modern, think what it created back then. What you call your basic mess. And the church was spiritually lethargic, not quick to beat this. And so there arose a great need for spiritual revival, and we begin to see it. Let's take our 10-minute break. And we'll pick up. Spiritual value amid all this immorality and bad stuff. I use architectural college word. All the icky poo morality that was going on, all the no-nos. Not on this test. Now it's kind of warm in here now, isn't it?
Yes.
William Law wrote a book, one of the most important books in the history of Protestantism, called
all in devout life. It's kind of like the writings of Spinner. He wrote his Pia Desideria. It's a call for genuine spirituality. He was a clergyman who didn't swear allegiance to the state church. He could, therefore, he could not preach, so he wrote. Serious Call was to become, I'm reading now, one of the most influential books of history. It had a tremendous impact on Wesley, and through this and other ways, it was perhaps the single most important encouragement to the great evangelical revival in England and America. You see, people have a desire for a relationship with God. Remember what? Remember Augustine's Confessions? It says, my soul will not find rest until it finds rest in you, O God. People want a genuine devotional life. People want to be the real thing. There's this longing. It's a contradiction of human nature. Men tend to sin, but men long for something better. In the opening, he declared, so what happened? This book got circulated and widely read, had a tremendous influence. He wrote in the opening, he is the devout man who lives no longer to his own will, but the way and spirit of the world, to the sole will of God. Considers God in everything, serves God in everything, who makes all parts of his common life parts of piety by doing everything in the name of God, under such rules as are conformable to his glory. And there it is. So that had influence. Isaac Watts had a bit, here's the influence of music. He's the father of English hymnody. If you study this, I'm going to do another course. Remember that I've already taught you that it was the Lutherans who sang, not the Reformed people.